funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much thought do you give to the message your spending sends to those who wield power and wealth? Most of us can recall pockets of high-profile consumer activism in recent history, from the efforts of safety crusader Ralph Nader to the 8-year boycott by many Southern Baptists of the Walt Disney Corporation. But as my guest today will explain, Americans have been using their purchases, or lack thereof, to influence those in control of public policy and private industry since before the United States had even come together as a nation in its own right. Lawrence B. Glickman is professor of history at the University of South Carolina. His latest book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. Larry, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
What we see here is that even before the start of the American Revolution, consumer activism was part of sort of the fabric of our culture. Will you talk about the earliest ways that it was used?
Absolutely, sure. The American Revolution was in large measure a series of consumer protests, that is, boycotts of British goods and punishment for those merchants who continued to sell British goods. And so from a very early point, Americans began to constitute themselves as a separate nation in large measure by what they were not buying, namely British goods, and by what they were wearing and buying, namely goods that were produced domestically. And so this tradition of boycotting, which a lot of us tend to think of as a 20th century development, really goes back quite a long way. And in fact, my book talks a little bit about what I call the early modern tradition of consumer protest. And one of the things that most historians have noticed is that even before people in early modern Europe had the modern right, political rights, such as the right to vote, they often expressed themselves politically through various forms of economic coercion of things that later became known as boycotts. And classic examples of this is throughout Europe, you have food riots occurring whenever the price of grain and bread gets too high. Organized groups of people would protest those high prices through not purchasing, through harming merchants who sold high-priced grain and that sort of thing.
And what became important early on for this to really evolve as a tactic was keeping those protests not simply local, but spreading them out over long distances.
Exactly. That's the real key to modern consumer activism. What I say in my book is that these early modern protests tended to be local and not widely publicized. What makes the American Revolution unique in the history of consumer activism and what sets it off on its modern path is that people who are protesting in Charleston, South Carolina, and Boston and Philadelphia are aware that they're doing it, they're trying to coordinate their actions, and they are publishing their actions in the print media in a way that had never happened before. And that is the beginning of what I call long-distance solidarity, which I think is at the heart of this tradition of consumer activism.
How long did it take that tradition of non-importation, which it was sometimes called, to have a real impact on the British economy?
Well, that's a great question, and historians actually debate whether it did have much of an impact or not. One of the things that scholars of this era know is that these boycotts were often avoided by merchants, and there were all kinds of smugglers and so forth, and so it's actually quite a big debate. I think, and this is something that's very common with consumer activism up till the present, sometimes the intended economic harm is not the main thing that comes out of a boycott, but rather new kinds of political communities. And I would say that in the case of the American Revolution, we might debate the economic harm done to British merchants, but I think we can't debate that these boycotts played a role in people thinking themselves as being part of a new political community, namely the United States.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So what it really did was allow people to define themselves as separate from the crown.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Abolitionists were influential in consumer activism in the 19th century, and they made a concerted effort to avoid buying things made by slave labor.
Absolutely, yeah. Abolitionists were a key group in large measure because they joined the boycott to what we today call the boycott. They didn't use that term, of course, but boycotts being the opposite of boycotts, where you coordinate the purchase of goods that you deem to be morally upright. And so the abolitionists were really the first people to market alternative morally sanctioned products, and they called these places where they sold them free produce stores, or sometimes free labor stores. They were stores where you can go buy goods that were sold without the taint of slavery, as they would say. And so they played a very important role in this tradition, because ethical shopping today is such a big issue. And again, we tend to think of it as a relatively modern phenomenon, but it actually has roots going back several centuries.
Yeah, it's like the antecedent of fair trade goods that we buy today.
Exactly. And even to the point where they sold certain labeled goods that were labeled as part of these, as part of free produce goods and so forth, and a lot of things that we associate with kind of modern consumer activism.
Was there such a thing at the time as a sort of counter effort? Were there people who, for example, didn't own slaves themselves but would seek out slave-made products, thinking that this was an institution that deserved to be preserved?
You certainly have a lot of Southerners, for example, saying that we need to support the slave economy. And you also had, it's interesting because like a lot of consumer activism, this so-called free produce movement was quite controversial. And you even had some abolitionists who said that this is not a good use of our time. And, for example, William Lloyd Garrison, one of the leading abolitionists, the founder of the newspaper The Liberator, which was one of the main abolitionist periodical, was someone who early in his career supported this free produce idea. But after around 1845, he began to think that it was a waste of his time. And he said things like he would proudly wear Southern-made cotton to fight slavery, because he didn't think it was so important compared with the political battle that he deemed to be more important. And so you got certainly a lot of criticism from the usual enemies, but as with a lot of consumer activism, sometimes the people who cared the most were other abolitionists who chose other strategies besides consumer activism.
Also an American tradition to argue about the best way to achieve whatever end that you want to get to.
Exactly. Yeah, there was a famous quote from Wendell Phillips, another very well-known abolitionist, who said he would proudly use sugar made by slaves as a way to fortify himself in the fight against slavery. So you do find dissent even as early as that period.
Lawrence B. Glickman is my guest. He's professor of history at the University of South Carolina. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. Let's talk, Larry, about the birth of the term boycott. This was actually borrowed from anti-colonialist activists in Ireland.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and really a transnational story. And that's one of the things that that I try to show in my book, is that a lot of consumer activism can't be located to a specific geographic place. And the term boycott is a great example. Some of your listeners may know that the term itself comes from a man named Charles Cunningham Boycott, who was a British land agent in Ireland. He wasn't a landowner, but he worked for a very wealthy landowner, and his job was to collect rent from poor Irish tenant farmers. And boycott was very, very unpopular, and as a way of protesting the treatment that they got from boycott, a group of Irish tenant farmers, along with some radical priests, began to ostracize boycott socially, as well as refusing to pay him their rents that were due to him. And it was actually an American journalist who was covering this event who coined the word boycott, because he and some of the radical priests were sitting around saying, how can we find a better word? Ostracize is kind of a complicated word. Let's find a simple word that really does the trick. And one of the priests sitting around the table said, how about boycott? And the man, the American journalist named James Redpath, said, that's a great idea. He quickly published an article about the rise of boycotts in Ireland for American newspapers and London newspapers, and the term spread like wildfire. One of the things that really shocked me, and nowadays with internet searches, you can really find a lot more precision about when terms were introduced where, but I found things like newspapers in Salt Lake City in, just a few months after the term was coined in October of 1880, would say things like, of course, you all know what the term boycott means, just maybe in early 1881 or something like that. Hmm. So it was a term that really caught on incredibly quickly and began to be used not just in the English language, but many European and even Asian languages adopted variations on that word very quickly.
Well, it's remarkable, especially given the relative slowness with which news and information could move back then.
It is, but of course, that was an era when, at the time, people were talking about a print revolution, and you know, the penny press and the daily newspaper was really a major issue in American, especially in American cities and so forth. And one of the things that I noticed in my research is that newspapers were not shy about reprinting articles from other newspapers, and so what you got was a very quick circulation, not as quick as in our internet age today, but within weeks or months, you would find terms of art such as boycott circulating very, very quickly.
Well, it's also interesting going back to this idea of long-distance solidarity, that this term came into common usage at a time when it was also important that movements stay not just in a local area.
Absolutely. One of the things that I found is that after, especially after the term was coined, before the term was coined, there were a lot of different words that people used for the activity that we today call boycotting. And one of the things that happened is I think it really, when a term was settled on, it really increased the speed with which boycotts took place and were broadcast and announced around the country and sometimes around the world. And in the 1880s was a time that was known in America as the era of the labor boycott. Organized labor, which faced a series of legal restrictions that made it very difficult to strike and do other things, quickly began to use the tool of the boycott. And oftentimes these were very, very local boycotts, very, very local events. You know, you might say, let's not buy beer from this brewer who doesn't hire union labor. But even the most local of boycotts were announced in the labor press and sometimes in the urban press and even the national press and so forth. And boycott lists, as they were called, became very common and were often circulated, especially in labor newspapers. They would list all the boycotts currently going on and so forth.
And there were three separate newspapers specifically called The Boycotter that were sort of dedicated to this idea.
Yeah, that really shocked me to discover that. But the term, the newspaper, The Boycotter, was used in New York, Chicago, and Topeka, Kansas. So that term spread very quickly as a name of a newspaper. And, of course, many other newspapers that didn't have the name did a similar job of kind of monitoring boycotts, describing their progress, and encouraging people to express solidarity to the boycotts that were going on. I was just going to mention that Terence Powderly, the head of the Knights of Labor, which was the largest American labor union in the 1880s, said something along the lines of that he had a list of 400 boycotts currently going on, and it was giving him a big headache to follow all of them. And it reminded me so much of contemporary ethical shoppers who sometimes express the same frustration with trying to keep track of all the activities that are going on.
Yeah, it can become sort of a full-time job if you're not careful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lawrence B. Glickman is my guest. He's professor of history at the University of South Carolina. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. We'll resume this conversation after a quick break and would welcome you to join us. You can get on the line now by calling 1-800-933-5372 if you would prefer to send email. That address, as always, is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of History at the University of Carolina, Lawrence B. Glickman. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Larry, I'm wondering, in the 19th century, when you have these boycotting newspapers and newsletters arising, were newspapers as ad-supported as they are today or would like to be today?
Absolutely. They were ad-supported, and that was one of the things that that often boycotters mentioned, that if we can cut off the ad support for newspapers, that would be a very powerful tool. And in addition, the boycotter newspapers would often say, if you support our newspaper, you should also buy goods from the people who advertise in our newspaper, because that's a way of extending solidarity to our supporters.
So I guess instead of sort of taking on risk by having their advertisers be threatened, they would simply only take advertising from people that they thought were okay.
Right. That's what they tried to do. And oftentimes when there were boycotts of newspapers, which was a very common, printers were among the most common trade unionists to organize boycotts. And of course, the group that they boycotted most often were their employers in the newspaper industry. And they often very much tried to encourage supporters of their boycotts not to buy goods from the advertisers, and to encourage advertisers to stop placing ads in those newspapers that were under boycott.
An interesting thing that you describe here is this phenomenon by which boycotters were encouraged to spread their spheres of influence. So if, for example, you didn't think anyone should buy a certain brand of beer, you wouldn't buy the beer. You also wouldn't patronize the store that sold the beer and another company that made the cans to put the beer in. And this could get really quickly sort of out of control.
Exactly. This was one of the biggest criticisms of boycotts in the 19th century. And after the mid-1880s, a series of legal cases entered the courts about whether boycotts were legal. And this is one of the key issues, is that boycotts called for citizens to act in these ever-spreading concentric circles and to economically punish groups that might only be tangentially connected to the original group that was boycotted. One example of this was that a group of unionists boycotted the Stetson Hat Company because of their labor practices, but then also boycotted, tried to organize boycotts of all the stores that sold them. And many of those store owners were saying, we treat our workers well, why should we be punished for just selling a product that some of our customers would like to have? And so there was a lot of talk in the newspapers about the violence of the boycott, because it could spread so rapidly and affect so many people, and the need to kind of contain boycotts so that they did not punish people unduly who were only peripherally connected. And ultimately, we got the legal term secondary boycott to refer to exactly that set of issues.
So things started to evolve in a different way beginning in the early part of the 20th century. Lots of different things happened, but one interesting development was that different minority groups started using boycotts to protect themselves from abusive practices.
Absolutely, yeah. One of the interesting things that you find about the boycott is that it's a practice that many, many groups, practically every large grouping we could think of in American history has used the boycott at one time or another. And late in the 19th century, but especially early in the 20th century, African Americans really pick up this tactic, especially in urban areas, and especially around the issue of segregation, which was a relatively new practice in streetcars in particular. African Americans in 25 southern cities organized boycotts of segregated streetcar companies.
And they also wouldn't buy products from stores that wouldn't hire African Americans.
Yes, they extended the boycott in a number of ways that were significant. One of them was the beginning of what became as the Don't Buy Where You Can't Work movement that really flourished in the 1930s but began earlier. And the idea here was that if we have stores in our neighborhood that don't hire African-American people, then we're not going to shop there because they're not being good citizens of the community.
And starting in the 1930s, American Jews stopped buying products that were being made in Nazi Germany. Did other Americans join them in this?
The anti-Nazi boycott was not a particularly economically successful campaign, but sure, it had a broad base of support, particularly among those on the political left at that time.
Yeah, you write about this really in the 20th century as being sort of a parallel history of American liberalism.
Yes, I think in a lot of ways you can track the nature and history of American liberalism in part through looking at what's going on in consumer activism.
Lawrence B. Glickman is my guest. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Glenn in Grand Prairie. Hello, Glenn.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a question comment for Professor Glickman. I'm interested in that the fact that since Barack Obama has been elected president, there's been a lot of concern by people about his record on Second Amendment rights, which has caused an incredible surge of buying power and firearms and ammunition. And want to know what the professor thought about that and if that's going to have any effect on public policy, if that has in the past, if this concerns politicians at all.
Have you followed that story, Larry?
I have followed it, and I think that it's a very interesting example of buying power, slightly different context than what I'm talking about in my book. I'd be really interested in knowing, and maybe Glenn knows this, about whether this has been organized. In other words, whether the NRA, for example, has urged its members to do this because gun control might be coming down the road or not. One of the things that I kind of make a distinction of in my book is I'm really interested in organized consumption and non-consumption efforts. And there's a lot of kind of unorganized non-consumption or consumption efforts that happen where a lot of people do something kind of on an individual basis. And I think I agree with Glenn. My inclination would be to say that this does seem to be not just individual actions, but it seems that groups of people kind of agree on this as a practice that they want large numbers of people to follow through on. And so it's an interesting example of that phenomenon of the boycott, although maybe in a very different direction that most of the ones I've studied have gone.
Based on your research, what distinguishes a successful consumer activist campaign from one that fails to have much effect?
That's a great question, Chris, and it's one that I spent a lot of time thinking about. I guess that I think one thing I would say before I answer your question is that a lot of times the successes of boycotts are unintended successes. In other words, something comes out of it that's very different than what the founders of the boycott wanted to happen. And I could give you some examples of that. But first, let me give you, I think, the two kinds of boycotts throughout American history that seem to be the most successful in my study are, one, extremely local boycotts. For example, I mentioned earlier the labor boycotts of the 1880s, where people might pick out a particular brewer or baker or shoe salesman or hat store and say, we don't want our members to buy from that merchant. And because oftentimes these merchants were in working class neighborhoods, and because that was the entire base of their customer support, these boycotts could be extremely effective and often ended with victory very, very quickly. So one would be the extremely local boycott, and the other kind of boycott that I find to be successful is kind of the opposite, which is the national or global boycott, and where usually here the goal isn't so much to inflict economic harm, that's part of it, but more to raise political consciousness about a particular issue. And the example I'd bring up here would be the United Farm Workers Great Boycott of the 1960s and 70s, where, according to a New York Times poll in 1971, more than 17 million Americans were boycotting table grapes. So it was very, very widespread. I'm not sure that you could argue that the growers were necessarily economically devastated by it. But I think what that boycott did all the attention it gave to the issues of farm laborers was it raised it as a political issue, and so was successful in that sense. And I think those are the models that I find to be most successful. I should note, however, that most boycotts, I think, throughout American history have not succeeded. And one of the puzzles that I kind of try to look at in my book is why, given their track record of usually not succeeding, why Americans turn to them again and again.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Do you think there's at least a sense for people that participate in these that although they don't have much power as individuals, they can feel as if they are doing something about a problem that really vexes them?
Absolutely. I think he just hit the nail on the head. I think that it gives people a feeling of being part of a broader issue. We all know how important our pocketbooks are in our personal and family lives. And it's for many people, it's an expression not only of their personal feelings about a political issue or an economic issue, but it's also an expression of solidarity with other people who may feel the same way, or it may be an expression of solidarity with a group of workers, or in the case of animal rights, it might be an expression of solidarity with other species. In the case of of ecological issues, it might be an expression of solidarity about the environment and so on.
You know, we've done a couple of shows with other authors recently who have studied the way we use our consumer purchases and the things that we buy and wear to express our personalities and tell the world what we value. And then there are, a series of questions that arise as to whether this matters at all and whether anyone else is paying attention. Did you come out of this thinking that maybe boycotts are not as valid a tool for political expression and political activism as we might have thought they would be?
No, not at all. Even though I find their success rate to be pretty low, I find it to be extremely valid as an expression of citizenship. I think that a lot of people learn a lot from being part of boycotts. One of the things that really does, I mean, today it's almost an article of faith that we're all familiar with globalization and interconnections. But I think boycotters were among the people from a very early date who were raising the issue of our connections to people that we never see, we never touch, but yet whose lives are deeply intertwined with our own, simply because we live in an economy where things are made distant from where we live.
You know, one of the big takeaways from the book, Larry, is the fact that this is not something that happens in a sort of flash in the pan fashion, that this has always been a constant part of our culture in the United States. Did you get the idea that each generation of consumer activists has sort of deliberately drawn on the examples of those people who came before? Or does each generation come to it thinking that they've almost reinvented this thing or invented it for the first time?
Yeah, definitely the latter, Chris. That was one of the things that really surprised me, is that compared with any other social movement that I know about, consumer activists have been particularly bad at remembering their predecessors. And so you find pretty much every generation reinventing the wheel, thinking they're the ones who were the first to do this or that aspect of consumer activism. When I began working on the book and was telling people about it, they assumed that it was a book about Ralph Nader, because he's as far back as most people think of when they think of consumer activism. And in my account, Nader is really almost the last act in a much, much longer history. But even Nader himself, I quote one of his speeches, even though he is maybe more aware than most, but even he had a fairly limited understanding of the degree to which he stood on the shoulders of many people who came before him.
Well, he's a fascinating case study, I think, because, you know, he was this huge force in the early 70s. And then by 1978, I guess you could argue that the demise of consumer activism was greatly over-exaggerated. Is that the expression? But it wasn't gone. But at that time, people thought it was dead.
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Ralph Nader was one of the leading proponents, and certainly the best-known proponent, of a plan to develop what was called the Consumer Protection Agency. This was to be a cabinet-level office in the federal government that would defend the consumer interest. It had a tremendous amount of support throughout from the late 50s through the 60s into the early 1970s. But it never quite went through both houses of Congress. The one time it did, President Ford vetoed it and so forth. And Ralph Nader was put a lot of weight behind this Consumer Protection Agency. And ultimately, in 1978, it failed really for the last time in the Carter administration. And a lot of people did think that that was kind of the last hurrah of consumer activism. I don't think that's so, but I think that certainly it was a blow to the consumer movement at the time.
Well, and there's no denying, though, that Nader had a huge impact on what we believe to be our rights as consumers. It's not caveat emptor, or it's not supposed to be anyway, according to the way people think business should be done fairly.
Absolutely. I think Nader was part, and again, I don't think he was the first, but he was probably the most prominent in a movement that kind of expanded what consumer activism was, because in the 19th century, consumer activism was really about what consumers could do to help other people. It really wasn't about how consumers themselves could be protected or how other people could help consumers. Consumers, in other words, weren't seen as a victimized group in society. But thanks to people from as early as the Progressive Era through Nader, I think people began to think of consumers as a group needing protection, as a group with its own interests, and to the point where many people believed that a separate cabinet-level body should be there, just as there was a Secretary of Agriculture, that there should be some sort of Department of Consumers.
It's been interesting to observe in your book that it seems like consumer activism historically tends to increase in times when money is tight. How do you explain that?
Yeah, well, I think it surprised me at first to kind of notice that pattern, but I think it has to do with precisely because money is tight and choices, we're more conscious of the significance of our economic choices in those times. And one of the things that is really notable is that the 1930s, the Great Depression era, is the time in American history, that decade, when there was more consumer activism of greater varieties than you've seen before or since. So I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that everyone was conscious of the significance of consumption. They might not all have been consumer activists, but you had people ready to believe that consumption was a very significant act, and because for many people there were scarce resources, this kind of jacked up the importance of it.
Lawrence B. Glickman is my guest. He's professor of history at the University of South Carolina. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. We'll take more of your calls to 1-800-933-5372 after the break. You may also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lawrence B. Glickman. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email. That goes to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Susan in Plano. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I was seeing in the news today about a national boycott of Whole Foods, which, of course, is frequented by mostly liberal social shoppers. And it was in response to the CEO of the company writing a piece about healthcare reform and taking a more conservative side, which has angered the more progressive Whole Foods shoppers. And, in fact, I think they can boast maybe 14,000 protesters or boycotters on one of their sites. And I was just wondering if your guests could comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Susan. I've been following that pretty closely. It's a fascinating example of the speed with which boycotts can develop, especially these days. It's very interesting because oftentimes when boycotters set up boycotts, they don't really comment on the politics of the business owner, what the politics of the business owner is supposed to be. But in the case of the Whole Foods boycott, I think you're right. A lot of the boycotters are saying, you know that your customer base is largely a liberal customer base, and therefore the fact that you're pronouncing these other policy solutions is particularly damaging. And so I've been very, very interested in that, and the language of not giving any more money to support his solution for the insurance crisis that we face is really so evocative of so many other moral boycotts in American history. So I can't help but think of other examples along in the past that this follows from.
It would seem like following the Whole Foods case that's going on right now would also be a great way to study the evolution of the sort of corporate response to boycotts. I have to imagine that corporations today are growing ever more sophisticated at responding, sort of spinning this in a positive way than they've been in the past.
Absolutely. There's a fairly long history going back to the really as early as the 1940s and 50s. Many corporations set up consumer affairs departments where they try to deal with potential bad publicity and put out their own spin on boycotts as they emerge and that sort of thing, and also try to have preemptive responses to that. I haven't followed, I haven't looked at the Whole Foods website, for example, but I'd be interested to see whether they've been kind of proactive in engaging the arguments of the boycotters.
And I guess there's two schools of thought there. Either you just sort of leave it alone or you try to explain your position, and you can make more enemies either way, depending on what you do.
Right. Sometimes leaving it alone might be the best policy, because one of the things that a lot of critics of the boycott practice have said going back again to the 19th century is that, you know, in the end, shoppers are going to do what's convenient and what's best for them, and eventually they'll tire of these moral campaigns and so forth. And so oftentimes businesses have followed that practice.
You know, an interesting example on the conservative side was the 8-year boycott of the Southern Baptist Convention and ostensibly many of its members of the Walt Disney Corporation. They were upset by sexual content in some Disney material and the sort of gay-friendly corporate policies. Was that a surprise based on the modern history of boycotting?
That's a great question. I think a lot of people took it to be a surprise. A lot of people assume that boycotts are inherently liberal or left-wing or progressive or whatever term you want to use. And what my study shows is that, in fact, boycotts are used by all political stripes in American history and really always have been. One of the early examples I give of a conservative boycott, if you will, is the group of Southern slaveholding forces who organized boycotts of abolitionists. This was kind of the campaign that fought against the free produce movement of abolitionists that we spoke about earlier. But even as early as the 1820s, 1830s, you have groups of people who say we need to punish abolitionists and we need to make sure that our money isn't going to support abolitionist campaigns and so forth. And so from the beginning, there's a to and fro where groups of all sorts are using boycotts or promoting what we call counter boycotts, which are kind of boycotts of the boycotters. So it didn't surprise me in the least, but I think because maybe the most famous boycotts of our recent past are the Montgomery bus boycott of the civil rights movement in the 1950s, led by Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and so forth, and the United Farm Workers boycott, we tended maybe to have an impression that boycotts were of one sort of political stripe, and I think history doesn't bear that out.
Let's go next to Kaufman, where we'll speak with Daryl. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. I just come out of a restaurant eating lunch and caught part of your program and realized that the Whole Foods boycott is very similar to what the conservatives did to the Dixie Chicks when they made a remark about President Bush. The conservatives turned on them and almost put them out of business. In fact, there was a documentary made about that.
That's a great point, Daryl, and that kind of supports what I'm saying before about how boycotts, there's no one group that's there for boycotts. Boycotts can be adopted by any group of any political stripe, and I think that's a great example. I think what also happens, though, is you wind up with people who say, well, those people are supporting our punishing the Dixie Chicks. We need to support them. We need to buy their CDs and so forth. And so you find, again, a kind of back and forth there. But it just goes to show, I think, that a lot of people do feel that consumption is a proper way to help, maybe not the only way, but a significant way of expressing your political point of view.
Let's go next to Jeff in Plano. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I have a question about what you brought up earlier about the lack now of a government function for CPA. And if that could, a government-level kind of consumer protection agency, if that could be replaced instead by something on the Internet, and if how would you go about, if you thought it was a good idea, how would you go about creating an unbiased clearinghouse of boycott ideas, things like that?
Well, that's a really good question. I think maybe we should separate out some issues. One is that what a government, a federal consumer protection agency would do. And one of the interesting things from my point of view is that after I completed the book in the last couple of months, in fact, there's been a lot of talk about a new kind of consumer protection agency, this one called the Consumer Financial Protection Agency that President Obama has promoted as part of his new plan for not only consumer protection, but for financial reorganizing. And this plan has not been voted on and so forth, but there are several bills in Congress about this. And a lot of the functions of the of this organization really parallel what the earlier CPA was going to do. In terms of the clearinghouse idea for information, that's a really great point. One of the things that one of the reasons why Consumers Union was founded in the 1930s was to provide something of a clearinghouse for information for consumers. And several of the people who founded Consumers Union really believed that it should not be a private function, which it was with Consumers Union, but should be a government function. And several of these people came out of various government offices that had to do with Bureau of Standards and so forth, that had to do with providing Americans with information about goods and standardizing goods and so forth. And those people argued very strongly that the government should play that role. And certain bodies, governmental bodies do so independently, but there's really no coordination of those consumer protection abilities, and that's why there was this call for some united organization. But I think you're right that the Internet could play a real role in facilitating getting that information out there.
We're talking to Lawrence B. Glickman about his new book, Buying Power. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Sandy in Dallas. Hello, Sandy.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for this program. Could you address something for me? In your research, did you find when advertisers boycott television shows, radio shows, magazines, newspapers, whatever, do you find that it's the consumer pushing the advertiser or the advertiser taking the initiative themselves?
That's a great question. I think you find both throughout American history. In my book, I was really mostly interested in grassroots, kind of bottom-up type consumer movement. So I was interested mostly in focusing on when groups of consumers, for example, would encourage advertisers not to advertise on this show or this magazine or that magazine and so forth. And you do find a lot of that. I mean, the Disney boycott that Chris mentioned earlier is an example of that. A lot of people try to focus on that. But I think that certainly when you're looking at buying power and economic power, you do have to take account of the fact that oftentimes that fact, if a business or an advertising giant is going to threaten to withdraw its ads from a program or a network or a magazine, that is going to have a huge impact. And we really need to look at that as well, even though that wasn't really the main focus of my book.
An email from Kyle in Fort Worth wants to know whether the organizations being boycotted have any legal recourse against those who organize a boycott.
This is an issue that was really debated in the courts for about 100 years. In 1982, there was a decision in the Supreme Court. It was a case called Hardwick versus Claiborne Hardware versus Mississippi, excuse me. And that had to do with a boycott that was organized by the civil rights group SNCC in 1966. The various state courts in Mississippi upheld the right of businesses that were boycotted to disallow the boycotts. Ultimately, the Supreme Court in 1982 ruled that boycotts were political free speech and that they were, legal under the United States Constitution. But there are certain kinds of boycotts that are legally disallowed, and there are certain restrictions on boycotts. But basically, the court said that boycotts are just another form of speech, and they're legal.
I know that historians hate to answer questions about what's coming next, but journalists love to ask them. So I want to ask you, where do you think the movement might be going, given the current state of consumer activism in the United States?
Well, as a historian, I could say I'm really interested in finding out, with maybe no special any more knowledge than anyone else, about what will happen. But I do see a pickup in, even in the last few months, in the number of proposed fairly prominent boycotts, Whole Foods being the most recent. But you may remember several months ago there was talk of a boycott of General Motors because many conservative radio hosts and so forth were opposed to the government bailout and so forth. So I see in these precarious economic times an acceleration of boycotts, and I'll be very interested in following the whole issue of consumer protection and where it goes. It's been drowned out in recent weeks by the healthcare debate, but I expect that that will come back as a major issue, and whether this Consumer Financial Protection Agency passes will be a real bellwether to me about whether we might see a revived consumer movement.
How often do you think boycotts run the risk of sort of adding more legitimacy to the very point that they are trying to shoot down? I think about the Whole Foods thing, and I wonder how many people would pay much attention to what the CEO of a grocery store chain had to say if there were not a boycott organized against him.
Well, I think that's a very important point. I think boycott organizers need to take that seriously. What is going to be the strategic impact of this and so forth? I think as far as boycott organizers are probably concerned in that case, I think they're probably very glad that that now many Whole Foods shoppers, if not most, know something about the politics of the guy who runs the company, whereas 2 weeks ago, most of us probably didn't know anything about that. So from their point of view, that might be one of those raising of political consciousness issues that I spoke of earlier.
Is there anything that you are actively boycotting these days?
I am not actively boycotting any products at the moment, but I do follow all the boycotts pretty carefully, and certainly have nothing against boycotting.
Are you confident that this renewed interest in consumer activism will outlive the recession?
Yes, I am. And the reason for that is because throughout American history, boycotts have been just a part of our political landscape, the way elections are. And I'm very confident that that will continue.
Lawrence B. Glickman is professor of history at the University of South Carolina. His new book is called Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in the United States. Larry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.